And he's also the author of the popular Sims popular camp. He's also used now by Dublin.
Great, thanks very much. So this is actually, I've only got 30 slides, so please feel free to interrupt or whatever. So I'm going to be talking about the work I've been doing with Anthony Challoner at the Institute of Astronomy, which is trying to do a sort of full CMB style general calculation of what you can see from the dark ages. And I'll try and explain, starting from the beginning, why there's a signal there and why it's interesting, and all interesting things about cosmology we could learn from the signal if it was observable. I'll also explain why it's actually a lot difficult to observe. So the physics in this talk is all actually pretty solid. There's nothing speculative about it at all. But it is observationally speculative that the observations are fairly futuristic, maybe 20 or more years time scale. So I should say that much of this work is actually terribly new. I mean, I think Scott and Rees first pointed out the main effect back in 1990. And then there are papers by Zadar and Malone, 2003, and various other people have looked at various aspects of looking at power spectrum. But we were the first people to do it, of course, with the general relativistic framework. So I'm going to start right at the beginning with Wayne's proxy history of the universe. So we start at the top left here with inflation or maybe some other model. This is what we want to learn about, really, from the observations, if you're a theorist like you are here. Then after inflation or whatever, we have some reheating, and at that point, the universe becomes a hot ionized gas, basically consisting of stuff we know about, which is electrons and protons and neutrons and photons and so on. And then the universe expands. During this epoch, the universe is opaque because there are lots of free electrons around, so the photons can't move anywhere. But it expands and cools down, and then after about 380,000 years, you get recombination, which is when the energy is sufficiently low that electrons and protons can combine to form neutrals and hydrogen. So after this epoch here of recombination, the universe becomes transparent. You basically have a gas, hydrogen, helium, which is transparent. So this is, in principle, the boundary between what we can observe with light and what we can't observe if the universe is opaque. So this is what we see in the CMB here. Then the universe expands some more, and you get growth of structures. And after a few hundred million years, you get nonlinear structures forming, you get stars, light being produced. At this point, the universe becomes really complicated. It's just a model of nonlinear physics. So the Dark Ages is this region here between recombination and the formation of the first nonlinear objects, where the physics is actually still very simple. You can still use more or less linear theory to calculate what's going on. But it's also, in principle, directly observable because the universe is transparent. If only you can find some way of observing what's going on there. So it's what you can observe that's still relatively easy in principle. So I've shown here, looking at the fluctuations, what you might expect to get at the end of inflation. So this is a picture of what the scale invariant spectrum looks like in real space. So you can see there are blobs of all different sizes. You've got big blobs and smaller blobs, very small blobs. And if you could observe this, you could take the power spectrum of it, and this would tell you something directly about what happened during inflation, about the structure and the potential as it evolved. But of course, we can't observe this directly because reheating the universe is opaque. So I have to try and evolve this forward to what you can observe, which is the recombination. So I can do that. So here you can see the evolution of these perturbations. So what's happening is structures are growing on larger and larger scales. There's more and more time for the gas to move around. And I'm going to stop this animation and recombination is what you actually observe. So that's there. So what you're actually observing is some processed version of those primordial fluctuations you got from inflation. And this is all you can observe directly. And now, instead of being scale invariant, this question here, you can see actually has characteristic scale blobs on it. So there's lots of blobs of this sort of size, and that corresponds to the characteristic size of the first acoustic peak in the microwave background, which is basically telling you how far a pressure wave can travel by recombination. But for the purpose of the talk, the main point I want to make about this plot here is that there is an absence of very small scale structure. So if I run this again from the beginning, you can see there's lots of very small-scale fluctuations here. These are perturbations telling about small-scale modes, things that left the horizon late during inflation. As this evolves, the hot and cold spots next to each other, the photons will diffuse between them, and they sort of get wiped out. It's called silt damping. So that erases any information in the CMB on very small scales. So all the information you want to learn about inflation on small scales is being lost in the CMB. So the idea of the Dark Ages is to try to get around this problem. So you can see here, very smooth on these small scales. So here's some reasons why the CMB is really good, which I'm sure you know all these. So The nice thing about it is you can perform linear perturbations, scalars, vectors, and tensors. In particular, this B-mode signature in the polarization of the tensor mode, which is a really powerful discriminator for models of the early universe. Since the CMB represents the boundary between when the universe was opaque and transparent, so this is the earliest you can observe, so it's the furthest back you can directly go towards that unknown new physics of the early universe. And because it's the furthest away you can look, it also probes the largest scale. So on the CMB, you'll see the largest scale you can probe observation. And of course, the really good thing about it is you can observe them now. We have these really beautiful double map data and so on, observing these spectra. But then there are these problems with the CMB. So the real stickler that's a lot of interest in recently is this fact we only have one sky. So you can get basically a few samples of these really large probes. And there's unfortunately nothing we can do about this, really, apart from nothing. I'm not going to give you an answer to this, I'm afraid. But the other two things I can give you an answer to, in principle. So this diffusion damping, there's a wiping out of the very small scale fluctuations. So CMB is limited to about 2,500 dNL, angular scale. A few arc minutes. Below that, there's really no information there at all. And the other thing with it is it's just the surface. You're looking at this large scattering surface. So it's only a 2D surface. But of course, there's information there in 3D, in principle. The universe is a 3D thing. So these two dark ages can, in principle, do something about improving on. So perhaps one way to do this would be to try and observe the dark matter perturbations. So I say explain the difference in photon diffusion between hot and cold spots, which wipes out the small-scale structure of the photon distribution. But the dark matter, because it doesn't interact with photons, actually has structure on all scales at large scattering. So if only you could observe that, all that information about inflation on very small scales would still be there. And of course, the dark matter has a 3D distribution. And of course, dark matter, by definition, it doesn't interact with light, so you can't observe the dark matter directly. But there are also these baryons, the hydrogen gas, basically. And of course, after recombination, you have a potential well from dark matter, baryons will be attracted into it, and you'll get fluctuations in all scales and baryons as well. So in principle, if you can look at the baryons, that's tracing the dark matter, and that has fluctuations on all scales. So the baryons contain all the information you've lost in the CMB about all scales. There's one caveat to that, and that's that the baryon pressure is non-zero. This is just the hydrogen atoms are whizzing around a bit. So there's some sort of finite size that you can go down. So the scale of this baryon pressure wiping out is much, much smaller than the CMB photon. So if you could look at the baryons, you get a much smaller scale than you could do from the CMB. So here's a sort of a comparison of information content in these two different things. So the CMB temperature goes up to, say, over 2,000. The number of modes goes like L squared, so you're saying maybe 10 to 6 different modes you can look at in the CMB. And the error goes like the square root of the number of modes. So this gives you, telling you, you can measure the power spectrum basically to about 0.1%. And the scale here corresponds to about 11,000. So this is what Planck will be doing. We should get, hopefully, something like this, more or less, out of Planck, the satellite, going up in 2008. For the dark age baryons, because we're now down to pressure damping scale of the baryons, the L scale of that is actually 10 to the 6, so we now have 10 to the 12 modes. And if you take the square root of this, tells you measuring things to an error of about 10 to the minus 6. So this is a much tighter error on the initial power spectrum. It's a tiny percentage error. And now on a much smaller scale, which corresponds to the damping scale due to the value of pressure. But actually, it's even better than that, because I was talking here just about one redshift surface about it. But in principle, you can observe these baryons in 3D. And if you think about 10 to the 6 L, the size that corresponds in terms of fluctuation, you get lots of different shells of that thickness in the dark ages. And so it works out to about 10 to the 4 different redshift shells you could observe. That gives you 10 to the 16 modes, and so forth. So you get an error of about 10 to the minus 8, in principle. So if you want to think about some speculative way of what, in principle, you could do about learning about inflation, so take a spectral index of 0.96, which is compatible with WMAP. If you have some slow roll model, then you get something like 1 minus NS squared, so the running of the spectral index is about 10 to the minus 3. But we have an error of 10 to the minus 8 to play around with here. So in principle, this is telling us we can measure the running of the spectral index even in the slow roll model to about 5 significant figures. So if we could do this, this would really be making cosmology up there in particle physics in terms of pursuing cosmology. So I hope I persuaded you this. In principle, there's something there to go after. So the idea is to think about how we could actually maybe try and observe these baryons. So to observe them, basically, we have to have some way of light interacting with the baryons in order for us to see them. So after recombination, we have hydrogen gas and helium. And because it's after recombination, that means most of the photons have an energy much less than the ionization energy of hydrogen or helium, which basically means all the electrons are in their ground state. And there are basically no transitions between electrons of hydrogen and helium. And that basically means there's no way you're going to observe these atoms by looking at transitions between levels. There's no line of radiation to look for. So what you need to do is basically have some transition of some energy corresponding to the photon energy around them, which is much lower than the light out frequency between the first and second shells. And there's basically only one candidate for this, actually, and this is this type of fine spin flip transition. So the idea is you have a hydrogen atom in its ground state, and the proton and electron spins can be either aligned or anti-aligned. And the anti-aligned one has slightly lower energy than the aligned one. So this is a triplet state here, where they're aligned, and you have a singlet state, where they're anti-aligned. The energy difference between these two turns out to correspond to a wavelength of about 21 centimeters. So what I'm going to be talking about is how you can use this 21 centimeter transition in the alignments of the spins of hydrogen atom in the dark ages to try and measure those baryons, hence get all that small-scale information in the power spectrum. So what people normally do, instead of talking about the number of triplet or singlet states, they try to find the spin temperature, which is just the ratio in the upper to the lower of these two states, given by e to the minus t over ts. And this defines t star, which is the temperature corresponding to this small energy level difference. And ts here is the spin temperature, so that just tells you about relative abundance of these two states. So what can we observe from these transitions? Well, if you have something in the excited state with a higher energy, obviously it can decay spontaneously to the lower state. So there's the spontaneous emission here between levels 1, the triplet state, and the singlet state. And the rate for this, you work it out, is about 10 to the minus 15 per second. That corresponds to a timescale of about 10 million years. So the order you can see that's interesting. The dark age is about 300 million years old. So the timescale of this transition is comparable to the timescale we're interested in probing in the universe. But actually, this is not the main effect, because there are lots and lots of background photons. There are 10 to the 9 times more photons than baryons. The main effect is actually stimulated emission, which is where you have a CMB background photon interacting with the atom, causing a change in the energy level. So the net number of photons here is the number in the upper state times the rate down, minus number in the lower state times the rate up, all times the background intensity of the CMB photons. So then you can write down an equation taking both of these things into effect, which is the net number of photons produced at this frequency, the transition. So you've got something here that depends on the transition rate going down times the intensity of the CMB, then this stimulated spontaneous term here. And this delta here is just telling you that I'm assuming the energy of the transition basically has zero line width, which is actually a pretty good approximation. You can integrate this off again over a window function if you want, for example, for observational bandwidth. And if you rewrite this expression here for the number of these photons produced, it turns out you can write it as basically it's proportional to the difference between the spin temperature and the CMB temperature. So there's T gamma here for the temperature corresponding to background CMB. So this kind of makes sense. So the spin temperature is different from the CMB temperature. You're going to absorb or emit photons from the CMB to try and equilibrate these two temperatures. So there will be some signal we could observe if these two temperatures are different. So to see whether we could actually observe this, you have to think about how the spin temperature and the CMB temperature evolve as a function of time during the dark ages. Okay. So what determines the spin temperature? Well, so there's this stimulated process, a stimulated emission from the atoms. So if you do that, then this is obviously coupling the temperature corresponding to the energy of the photons with the energy levels of the atom. So the spin temperature is driven towards the CMB temperature by the stimulated emission process. There's actually another process that affects the spin temperature, and this is collisions between the atoms. So if you have a collision between two atoms, that can redistribute the hyperfine states. And the characteristic energy corresponding to a collision, obviously, is the kinetic energy of the atoms. The kinetic energy of the atoms is governed by the temperature of the gas. So collisions between the atoms drive the spin temperature towards the gas temperature, called TG. So we've got these two competing effects here. They're trying to drive the spin temperature towards these two different temperatures. Okay, so CMB temperature, well, we all know how that evolves, just mentioned, so we have a scaling like 1 over A here. Now the gas temperature is a bit more complicated. So what's happening with the gas temperature is that at early time there are some free electrons around. And if you have competent scattering of the photon off a free electron, there'll be some transfer of energy between the photon and the electron. And that will couple the temperature of the atoms by the electrons to the temperature of the CMB. So at early times, when there are free electrons, competent scattering couples the gas temperature to the CMB temperature. Okay. So Tg is CMB. So in this equation here, you've got this redshifting term, Hubble term, and then you've got something here which depends on the ionization fraction. And at early times, the ionization fraction is high, so that basically forces these two terms to be equal, so the gas temperature is the same as the CMB temperature. So at early times, you see nothing. All the temperatures are the same. Spin temperature is the same as the gas temperature, CMB temperature. So there's no signal in the 21 centimeter. However, at later times, of course, these electrons and protons are recombining, and at that point, when there are few free electrons, this term becomes zero. And at that point, the gas starts to cool adiabatically. So the temperature of the gas is like V squared. And the V is ratio of like 1 over A. So this is something that adiabatic cooling of the gas corresponds to the scaling of 1 over A squared of the gas. But at later time, the gas temperature is going to be lower than the CMB temperature. So that's telling you you are actually going to see something in the 21 centimeter transition. At late time, the spin temperature is below the CMB temperature, so they'd like to absorb, the gas would like to absorb CMB photons to get back up to the CMB temperature. So there should be a net signature in absorption. So has anyone got any questions? I've tried to explain that, but it's quite a lot of physics in that. Okay, so there's actually another complication that I'm not going to talk about, which is the late times when you have stars forming, you get energetic photons. So you do get these light photons meeting once you have stars and quasars and stuff. That also affects the spin temperature, but that's not important during the dark ages. I'm talking about simple physics when there are no light alpha photons around. So it's just these two processes governing temperatures. Okay, so you can write down an equation now for the evolution of the number of atoms in the ground state and the upper state. So something like the evolution of the ground state number depends on the collisional rate and the spontaneous and stimulated rates. And then if you can then argue about the time scales. So time scales for collisions are much shorter than the Hubble time, which basically means that this term on the right-hand side has to be zero. And that tells you this equation related to spin temperature to the CMB temperature. So you need to worry about the details of this equation, but the results are basically shown in this figure here. So this is redshift along here. And you can see CMB temperature, which is this dashed line here. So that's just redshift, it's 1 over A. The gas temperature, at early time, you have these free electrons, which covers the CMB temperature. So the gas temperature follows the CMB temperature early on. Then it cools adiabatically, like 1 over A squared, coming down here. And then you've got to think about the effects of these different couplings. So this line here shows the collisional coupling. So at early time, the universe is dense, so lots of hydrogen atoms hit each other once a year or something down here. As the universe expands, they hit each other much less frequently. So the time scale for collisions is growing very rapidly to go to lower redshifts. But at late times in the universe, these atoms very rarely hit each other. It's pretty lonely in the dark ages down here. You only ever see another atom every 1,000 years. But then if you look at the spontaneous interaction rate, which is this line here, you can see that at late times, there are still loads of CMB photons. That comes to dominate. So once the universe has expanded so much, the atoms never hit each other. There are no collisions. At that point, the rate governing the temperature is from the CMB temperature, so there's still lots of photons. And at late times, the spin temperature comes back up to the CMB temperature here. Right. Since you get a signal and the spin temperature is different from the CMB temperature, you can see there's this window here between a few hundred and around 30 when the spin temperature is below the CMB temperature. And that'll give you, that's telling you there should be a signal around absorption you could look for to learn about these small scale fluctuations. So there are two other complications in principle that I plotted here, which are collisions between electrons and hydrogen, the very small number of free electrons and protons and hydrogen. And those are subdominant collisions between hydrogen and hydrogen. Some of them are small corrections, but they are there. Okay, so there's a window here where you can, in principle, observe the baryons in the dark ages. So there's a few subtleties that I should quickly mention. Because talking about spin temperature as the ratio of the states is a very sort of crude background way of describing the states. For example, if you have a triplet state, I mean, how do you know that it's distributed everywhere in space the same way? Maybe all the atoms are aligned. And another fun fact is that how often an atom hits another atom obviously depends on how fast the atoms are moving. So in principle, the rate of collision depends on atomic velocity. So in principle, you can't just use a gas temperature, a spin temperature. Actually, everything is a distribution function of how far, how many atoms are moving at different speeds and how often they collide and so on. So there's a nice paper by Hirsch and Sigurdsson where they look at this effect. And in fact, it is important in principle to do that. But it's a few percent effect. This makes everything vastly more complicated. So I'm not going to go into this in more detail, but there is an effect there in principle. And then there's this problem of whether the triplet states are actually isotropical. For example, if you have an anisotropy in the background photon distribution, you might think the triplet states would align themselves somehow with the background radiation direction. So what saves you here is that, of course, you have collisions between atoms pointing in different directions. They're going to typically randomize when they hit each other. As long as there are lots of collisions, that will tend to randomize the orientation of the spin states. And there's also an effect that the dominant anisotropy in the CMB is from the motion of the atom, which gives you a dipole. The dipole has the wrong parameter coupled to these things. So in fact, there's a very small effect coming only from higher order moments of photon distribution. So this is basically fine. There are enough collisions. There's no coupling that actually gives you the isotropy term. So it's a good approximation. Spin temperature is fine. Everything is distributed and it's isotropic. So there is this effect here in velocity that the spin states are aligned to isotropic. Okay, so I said there should be an absorption signal there. Or what you want to observe really is the power spectrum, it's linear physics, inflation fluctuations of gas, and then these should be more or less gas, and then everything's in the power spectrum. So we have to try and calculate the power spectrum of the fluctuations in this radiation absorption in the CMB you can observe. So the background terms proportional to this here. So obviously NH, that's the number of atoms. If you have more atoms around, you can get more absorption. There's a spontaneous rate here, and there's this difference between the two temperatures. So there's no background signal if the spin temperature is the CMB temperature, as I said before. Now, if you perturb this, then you have a monopole perturbation term. So it's just perturbation in the number of hydrogen atoms. If you have more hydrogen atoms locally, you get more absorption locally. And there's also effects due to the perturbations in these different temperatures. You've got a difference between the spin temperature and the gas temperature perturbations. Okay. So you can write down an evolution equation for the distribution of these photons as a function of time. So this is basically trying to reproduce what you do for a CMB if you want to work out the angular power spectrum by doing it for emission from these 21 centimeter photons. So you just write down an evolution equation along the line of sight for the number of these 21 centimeter photons emitted or absorbed. So this is the background term. And you have this source here from the fluctuations of the density. You've got this term here. So what's going on here? Because if you have a gas atom moving with respect to the CMB, it's going to see a dipole. And if it sees a dipole, that means it's going to be hotter in one direction than the other direction, which means the spin temperature and the CMB temperature can be more different in that direction than in that direction. So you'll get more absorption. So this is telling you if the gas is moving away from you, it sees a dipole, and you get this preferential absorption proportion to the velocity. And there's a similar effect for higher order moments, which is very small. And then, obviously, you have to relate the energies to the rest frame of the atom. We're assuming this thing emits isotropy in its rest frame. So there's a doctor term here, which is related. Velocity, gas. And there are some other terms, which are very small, I'm not going to talk about. And then you can just integrate that equation along the line of sight. In principle, that tells you today what are the isotropies on the sky that you can see. So out front here, there's just the background term. There's a damping feature of reionization. So if there are 21 centimeters of photons around, they will scatter off the electrical reionization, and they'll be damped, just like the CMB, e to the minus tau. You've got a monopole term. There are some general relativistic terms here, which is relating the proper time in the gas frame to the time in dE along the line of sight. Then you've got this velocity dipole term. Then, in fact, the main extra effects, apart from the perturbation of the gas that you hear, are due to redshift distortion. So this is relating an interim frequency today to a proper distance along the line of sight. So if you have a radial gradient in the velocity, that makes it look compressed. And you get a term here corresponding to radial gradient velocity along the line of sight, and some GR terms here as well. And then there are some really small terms. So here, anyone who's done CMB detail will recognize these terms. This is the difference between the potential of the source and now. It's just a Sachs-Wolfe effect. It's a Doppler effect, the velocity of the gas at the source. And there's an integrated Sachs-Wolfe, which is just redshift in the first one along the line of sight, so potential is there. And then there's some very small terms here due to scattering the ionization. And on small scales, which is about where most of the information is, you can forget most of these general relativistic effects. And then the perturbation of the scene is just basically temperature, perturbation of the gas, the temperatures and this redshift distortion. These two are actually equivalent. So this redshift distortion and the same order of magnitude. So redshift distortion is really important. These two terms boost the spectrum about what it would be if you just had this monoclonal source. Yeah, that's probably more information than you wanted, but here's the answer of what you get to actually do it numerically. So these are the transfer functions, which tell you the function of k, what the power should be today. So on large scales, these are where the potentials outside the horizons are more or less constant. So the density fluctuations go like k squared, so that's growing up here. Then they come inside the horizon in radiation domination, then you start to see the baryon oscillations. And then scales that are well inside the horizon of radiation domination just grow logarithmic. So this is a dotted line, shows the CDM power expression, just growing logarithmically to very, very small scales. The cutoff here in the baryon, this is describing the electric pressure, just that the atoms are moving around, so you can't probe very, very small scales. And then there are I've shown you the various different terms. They all basically have the same shape. They grow logarithmically on small scales, and they cut off on small scales due to the baryon pressure. This here shows a comparison with CMB, just to show you really how much more information you're getting, how different scales are from the paper that came out last week. So this is the CMB here, and this 21 centimeter power growing on much, much smaller scales. Significantly larger range in K. So indeed, looking at this, we can look at the baryons in the dark pixels in this redshift window. Of course, you can't actually observe the transfer function directly, so you have to look at the angular power spectrum. And this is very much like the CMB, just do some integral work, some Bessel functions. And this shows you what the angular power spectrum should look like today. So again, you have growth on large scales, logarithmic growth on small scales, and cutoff due to the pressure. So I have shown here some different intervals and frequencies. So if you have an observation trying to measure radiation at a particular frequency, you typically have some bandwidth. It means you're basically averaging over a small redshift shell. If you're averaging over a redshift shell, that means you've got a line of sight suppression. Because if you have hot and cold spots along the line of sight, slightly cancel each other off. So that gives you this fall off in power on small scales if you have a finite bandwidth to the experiment. And if you have a thick redshift shell, then you can actually see the baryon oscillations here on small scales. On large scales, you're basically getting white noise. So this is because the spectrum is growing very rapidly with K. On large scales, the main effect is just random shot noise in the very small scale fluctuations, which gives you a white noise spectrum that correlates with each other. So it's very white, and then grows logarithmically because it's suppressed by the window. So in principle, this is directly observable. So what about the large scales, all these GR effects and things that they calculate? Well, they're actually very small. So I'm showing here up to about 100, so we're talking about very large scale loading. So this is the monopole term and the ratio of distortion, which is clearly dominated in the signal. Then if you want to look at, for example, the integrated Sackwolf effect, which in the CMB is quite important for the large scales, that would be this term here. So it's really very small compared to the other. In fact, the dominant term is this dipole effect due to the motion of the gas along the right-hand side, giving you preferential absorption. But it's still significantly subdominant, so it's maybe a few percent as corrections, but it's not very important. And on small scales, it's basically entirely given by the densities and the regime distortion effects. Now, it can be a bit misleading, actually, thinking about one redshift shell. Because obviously, you've got lots of redshift shells. If they're correlated to each other, then you can hide information, correlations between redshift shells. So one way to show this up is to just average a really thick redshift shell. So here I've shown Z between 33 and 47. And now you can see that on large scales, in fact, some of these extra terms are becoming important. So this is various combinations of Sackwolf and so on here. So it's actually dominating the monopole terms on very, very large scales. But they're still clearly subdominant. So it's going to be very hard to learn about large scale fluctuations from physical physics, is the basic message of this. And this picture, I hope, explains more or less why that's true. So this is actually more or less the scale in co-moving distance. So we sit here, the origin of the universe is about 14 gigaparsecs away, and the dark ages here are about 2.5 gigaparsecs thick. If you have some fluctuation that corresponds to L of 10 on the sky today, that's a blob of this size here. You can see that the CMB, which is in red, and dark ages, are basically going to have to see the same fluctuation on the scale. So the fluctuations you're seeing in 21 centimeters on very large scales, again, the same as you see in the CMB, so there's basically no new information about large scales. In fact, it's a lot worse with 21st century because inspection rises to small scales. You get this white noise spectrum on large scales, which complicates matters. So although we did lots of heroic work calculating all these large scale things, they're all fairly small. So another thing you might think about, so you know that B modes in the polarization are a very good flavor of gravitational waves. Well, maybe there's some interesting polarization signal in 21 centimeter. So this is Wayne Hu's animation of what's going on. So you send in some unpolarized light on the left. You have a free electron, I call it oscillate up and down, and scatter in this direction, giving off linear polarization. But exactly the same as the CMB, it's just constant scattering from an electron. Then you think about what happens if you have different intensities coming in on the left from the side and from the top. So if you have strong intensity coming in from the left, that causes it to oscillate this way, and you get linear polarization coming off this way. Down here, you get the same thing, oscillates that way, and you get less polarization. So there's some net polarization coming from the scattering, if there's anisotropy in the distribution of the photons when it scatters. So this is exactly the same as the CMB. And since there are perturbations, we know the distribution will be anisotropic, so there should be some polarization there. The question is, does it actually contain interesting information? So there are basically three effects that give you this polarization signal. What gives you this anisotropy? Well, there's going to be scalar mode, so there will be some anisotropy in the 21 centimeter realization. That gives you a signal from scalar modes. And gravitational waves are actually two effects. This is a bit subtle, but there's gravitational waves between the absorption surface and recombination. They will give you an anisotropy at the scattering surface, and that gives you some perturbations in the scattering surface, which then gives you a component of realization, you can see. And there's also the fact that if you have homogeneous absorption on the surface, then you have gravitational waves along the line of sight that redshifts photons in an anisotropic way, giving you a quadrupole component of realization. It's quite complicated, but the end result is it doesn't really matter very much because the signal is very small. So I've shown you here what you expect to see in the CMB. So this line here is what is the standard EE power spectrum from the black-body CMB photon. So what we're looking at in 21 centimeter is a very low frequency tail of this distribution. And at that frequency, this is what the power spectrum should look like, just from the black-body, even if there was no absorption from the dark ones. And you can see here, red, 21 centimeter signal is actually well below the black-body signal. And it decays off on small scales. On small scales, it's basically unpolarized. There's no new information. And on large scales, it's much lower than the black body signal. Now the tensor signal, which is what everyone's really excited about for CMB polarization, I've shown here for R is 0.1. And indeed, you do get a 21 centimeter signal. But it's right down here. So it's actually below the signal you expect to get from secondary gravitational lensing over the scale of it. So I don't have time to go into explain this, but I have a review from last year if anyone's interested to explain where the signal comes from. But this signal from 21 centimeter is a couple of orders of magnitudes lower than the signal which would be there for the black body. So basically, if this intensity is there, we're going to see it in the CMB polarization temperature at high frequencies, well before we're going to see it in 21 centimeter. So just have a bit of patience for a few technical details for anyone interested in the perturbation theory of the CMB. So to do all this, you have to work out the evolution of the gas temperature and the perturbation of the gas temperature as a function of time. And then that can affect what happens to the barrel. So I'm going to explain that now. So this is a second order equation for evolution of density perturbations in the gas. So this probably looks fairly familiar here. It's a second order differential equation. For CDM, there's no pressure, so this term is missing. And basically on the right here, you've got something that depends on the radius of the potential. But for the baryons, there is a pressure term here, which is basically delta P. And for a perfect gas, P of U equals nRT, so you can write down what delta P is in terms of temperature, perturbations in the number, and the temperature. So delta P, which is here, is just the perturbation of the gas temperature and in the CMB temperature, and the perturbation in the density of the gas and the perturbation in the temperature. So the perturbation in the temperature affects the evolution of the baryon perturbations. So the evolution of the temperature perturbation, well, you just perturb that equation I showed before. So I don't want to go into the details of this. You can write down an equation of how the gas temperature perturbation evolves. And the interesting point here is that this actually depends on the fluctuation of the ionization fraction. So normally when you do the CMB, people don't talk about the ionization fraction perturbation. The reason is is if you have a homogeneous loss scattering set and you put some free electrons there, you can't see it. So everything's just isotropic as far as that electron is concerned. So you can't see anything. So in the CMB, there's no effect at all from ionization factor perturbations. But here, it is coming in. So this 21 centimeter is going to be sensitive to fluctuations in the ionization function. Which basically means if you want to predict everything accurately, you have to understand recombination and perturbed recombination in order to do it. And the other interesting thing is that this then comes into the baryon density. So if you want to calculate fluctuations just in the baryons on the small scale, you also have to understand perturbed recombination. So, for example, if you're going to simulate galaxies on very small scales, starting with some initial conditions at high redshift, to calculate that power spectrum, you have to resolve these equations carefully to get the right result. And this is a linear effect, but I don't know what this means. So there's going to be a code version of CAN out there, which we'll use. Anyway, so this picture just shows quickly what's going on. So this is redshift here. This shows baryon density here. So when the this is Xe in cyan here. So right on the right hand side there are lots of free electrons. And the baryons are coupled with photons, so they're very low power because of photon diffusion. And after recombination, the baryons grow more or less like the CDM. Then I've shown in red the ionization fraction, which actually grows to be of comparable order of magnitude. So it is quite important, the ionization fraction perturbation. And then green shows the temperature fluctuation. And the effect of including the ionization fraction perturbations can be clearly seen there in the difference between the two lines. It's not a big effect, but it's quantitatively important. And this shows you what happens if you take a very small scale baryon perturbation and evolve it at the time. So this is the effect of the baryon pressure here, this mode is wanting to oscillate until late times when the gas cools and the sound field becomes very low. And the difference between these two, from including the XE perturbations and the ionization fraction, is about 10%. So it's an important quantitative effect at high redshift. Okay, so I'll just quickly go over a few more complications. So I said that the dark ages are easy because physics is basically linear. And of course, we're going to much, much smaller scales than the CMB now. And that means that, in fact, nonlinear evolution can be important even during the dark ages. So the reason here is that if you're looking at a small-scale fluctuation of that size, the fluctuations on that scale include perturbations of all the larger scales going out of the horizon-sized perturbations. They also build up logarithmically, which means that the fluctuations on small scale could be significantly larger than you thought they would have been naively. So I've shown here, if you just do a perturbation theory calculation to third order and work out the power spectrum of the CDM. So this is a linear term here. And you can see these nonlinear terms growing as you go to small scales. So even at a redshift 50, there is like 10% effect due to nonlinear evolution in the dark ages. So this is really telling you that if you really wanted to do those high precision constraints on cosmology, you're going to have to do the nonlinear evolution to resolve the perturbations very well.
So you
use
the word probably.
What does that mean? Okay, so the third order perturbation theory, you're. The way they do this is that you neglect the baryons. You assume the baryons and the dark matter follow each other exactly, so you have just one fluid. And then to do it, they also make the assumption there are no decay effects. Everything is growing. So there are approximations that go into the standard way of doing this calculation. So the probability is just the assumption that those terms are all small.
But I mean, this assumption cannot be independent of the scales you are considering, right?
Sure. Yeah. So if you go on to small scales here, then baryon is going to be quite different from the CDM.
Yeah.
And so the correction from that will be the CDM. But I don't think it will be very, I mean, this order of magnitude, I think, will be right. It will be a quantitative effect. And the baryons are only like 1/5 of the CDM, so there'll be something there probably at that sort of level, the correction to the correction.
So what is third order perturbations theory precisely means? It's really cosmological perturbations?
This is doing Newtonian perturbations, because you're well inside the horizon, so you just do Newtonian physics, you write down you're going through what velocity and density and so on, and then expand it all. So it's a bit of a mess, but it can be done. So I've shown here why you get to convert this into the angular power spectrum, which is what you're actually observing. You can see there's maybe a 10% effect at redshift 30 on very small scales, due to nonlinear evolution. There's actually another nonlinear effect which can be important, which is gravitational lensing. This is just a fluctuation right over here. You're looking at it through a perturbed universe. So the photons are going to be bending due to gravitational lensing, and that acts to slightly blur out the fluctuation of the original surface. This is just like in the CMB. So what it does is it blurs out the spectrum slightly due to the photon deflection. I've shown here some baryon wiggles in 21 centimeter. You can barely see it, they're slightly smoothed out at the sand level. I've shown the cross correlation of two lone shift shells. You can actually see the baryon oscillating much clearly, more clearly, which I've shown here. Then the lensing shown in lead, showing it's being smoothed out, these oscillations. So this is very much like what happens with single polarization. You get maybe 10% or 5% effect smoothly at three peaks in the power spectrum of future lensing. This effect is actually very easy to include. So I have some papers calculating how you do this. That's fine. Okay, so I've told you all the wonderful things you'd like to do in principle. Well, can you actually do any of this? And unfortunately, it's difficult. The main reason is that we're talking about 21 centimeter frequencies at the source, which is a high redshift. Because we observe that after it's been redshifted. So the frequency today is 1 plus Z, 21 centimeters. So from the dark edge, you're talking about wavelengths of many meters. And observing many meter wavelengths from the radio is quite challenging. In particular, if you want to go about Z of 70, then the atmosphere becomes opaque in the ionosphere. So the sort of suggestions for doing this are actually you have to go outside the atmosphere, preferably go to the moon. And of course, because you're looking at radio frequencies, there's lots of radio on Earth, so there's going to be lots of terrestrial interference. So to get away from that, you really have to go around the other side of the moon so you can't see the radio from the Earth. And if you actually work out the collecting areas, you mean they're actually very large as well, so you probably have to cover by a significant fraction of the far side of the moon in check to do this. So in principle, it could be done. Except possibly the foregrounds. And the problem here is there's lots of synchrotron emission from the galaxy, and that is actually significantly above any primordial signals will be there. And at the moment, people aren't very sure about whether this is a massive problem or not. This could possibly kill it off, or it may be that this is manageable. So it's very difficult. So there is actually one savior here. It's because you're looking at huge wavelengths, this basically means you only have to build your detect accuracy on a scale much smaller than the wavelength. So basically, you can build detectors out of chicken wire or something really, really crude, and be absolutely fine that the wavelength is so large. So although it is difficult, you need large areas, they don't have to be precision instruments. So there are some papers that have some speculations about how you might actually do this. I should also say there's currently planned 21 centimeter observations. This is actually quite a growth area, but they're all looking basically at reionization or a bit before it. So there's less than a redshift, which is about 20. So unfortunately, on these scales, everything is much more complicated and depends on when the source is formed and how much radiation they emit and so on. So it's very hard to learn about cosmologies, which is probably what you're interested in here, from these experiments. So you really do need to go to the dark ages to get clean physics and learn something very new, other than just learning about parameters of reionization. So in fact, there was a NASA would put out a question asking for things that could be done from the moon as part of the sort of stepping stone to Mars. So people have been dreaming up some mad ideas about what you might do. So this actually shows some artist's impression of what would happen if you unrolled a piece of plastic with some dipoles embedded in it on the far side of the moon. So this is in principle the sort of thing that might be done in the future. So it's speculative, but people are semi-seriously talking about it. So here's just a collection of various other things you could actually learn from the signal if you could observe it, whether it's really worth the effort. So as I said, you'll get two measures of the power spectrum basically in the fluctuation. You're getting really tight constraints on the power spectrum fluctuation on small scales. There's a paper recently about varying alpha. So this spontaneous emission rate actually depends on alpha to the 13th. So it's a very sensitive probe of variations in alpha. So if you can probe variations in constants during the dark ages, it's very high precision in principle. As far as curvature modes, so the CMB, you can't tell at all basically whether you have an isocurvature mode in the baryons or in the dark matter. But because here you're probing the baryons directly, you can distinguish those cleanly. So it's, as well as having lots of information high precision, you can also distinguish modes that you couldn't see in the CMB. You have particle decays or annihilations in the dark ages from the CDM, for example, that will change the temperature evolution, and you'll see that in spin temperature fluctuations. Primordial non-Gaussianity, well, you just measure, instead of measuring the power spectrum, you just measure the trispectral, the four-point function, and so on, on the higher order ones. From the dark ages. And in principle, this can get you down to a very small FNL. The problem here is, of course, there's this non-linear evolution, which tends to hide anything from inflation. So you're pretty much guaranteed to see a non-Gaussianity signal that's going to be predominantly from non-linear evolution, rather than from non-Gaussianity as modes left the horizon for inflation. And I wrote down a few other things I thought, you can almost certainly constrain if you could do this. So maybe cosmic strings, warm dark matter, neutrino masses, very dark energy, modified gravity, basically anything that affects the baryons at early times. So this just shows here a plot from the paper by Logan's Alvariado, where they have four different cosmological models, which are varying significantly. But you can see there's an enormous difference in this power spectrum, smaller scales, these different models. So this fine one here includes running, and this one doesn't. So you're talking about maybe millions of sigma detections of this sort of variation in the running due to the change in the small scale power spectrum. So that's pretty much it. There's a huge amount of information there. It is very difficult, though, because of this very large wavelength. You're not actually getting more information than simply on the very large scale. So it doesn't help at all with the fine volume and cosmic variance effects. You are getting a lot more information on small scales. If you want to do this to the high precision, then you really have to do everything very carefully. You have to understand the recombination. You have to understand fluctuations in recombination. You have to understand nonlinear evolution. Unfortunately, there's no polarization there. That may actually help to some extent because you can observe things polarized, and that would help you distinguish the foregrounds from the signal. So it's not, that may actually be a good thing rather than a bad thing. Polarization is small. So if you can do it, you learn lots of interesting things. I'd like to finish, if I can, by just advertising a couple of websites. So change of topic. This is Cosmo Coffee, which I set up with some people a few years ago. So the idea here is that you discuss papers as they come out. I'd really like to see more involvement of people from more theoretical angles, such as yourselves, on this website. There's quite a few interesting discussions about GPA, but they're mostly at the moment more towards observational or statistical issues. And it'd be really great to see some more discussion of papers. So maybe if you see something you think is obviously wrong, and I'm not on there, but if you say something, you could ask some questions about the papers or whatever. And there are other questions here, but you're asking general questions and also support the software and whatever. There's also a useful feature at the top here, which is archive new filter. So this, what you do is you give the site your keywords, and it filters today's archive based on your keywords. So this is what I got today, which is based on my keywords, and they're sorted in order of the number of keywords. So it just helps you see what's going on in the archive. So maybe you find that useful. And another thing that we're doing is this project called Ryoka, which we're trying to answer this question, which is, do we need conventional journals? So I think many of us today get all our papers basically from the archive. The journal is more or less redundant. We really don't need the libraries to pay £50 million a year to subscribe to the journals where we can get things online. So the idea is to investigate how you can build the useful functions of journals, for example, the refereeing process, on top of the archive, and only have one version of the paper on the archive. So this is actually a funded project for 1 year. These are the library people and these are cosmologists. And they need to be asked, sending out questionnaires and things to people to find out what people want from journals. Whether, if they're an editor, they need to be paid. Whether they want to see interesting changes to how journals work, how the refereeing process works, and so on. So if you're contacted, please do think about what you'd like. And if you have any ideas, please just tell them to me, and I'll be very interested to hear. Okay, thanks very much.
In our case, it just removed all references to published papers and journals. Maybe this is a less convention.
Have they?
Yes.
I haven't noticed that.
They have.
They are. So all those...
As of April 1st,
that's probably a bug, isn't it?
Citations to journals have been removed.
Interesting.
Isn't that right, sir? He's written the letter.
But it wasn't a different study because they were just giving this 8-digit number and not telling you in what subcategory of the archive something was published. I complained about that.
Have you heard anything?
No.
I think they've probably been invented with the
games. Yeah.
Maybe it's necessary to say we don't need the journal.
Yeah, some, they are actually involved in this project with me, so yeah. I suspect they screwed it up.
This is according to Stockman and Al, I don't know what Cambridge thinks about this, we know what Princeton thinks. According to Stockman and Al, in the power spectrum, there's strange things happen 60 degrees. So, in the power spectrum, there's no correlation between fluctuations about 70, 80 degrees and ones below. He believes this is said. What do you think?
Well, I think it is.
This is an important thing.
I think it is there, in the sense that if you
can't... inflation, unless you cook it.
Right, so you always have to fine-tune inflation so that it starts just at the right cycle or whatever.
So what does Cambridge think?
I think most people think that it is there, and it's a statistically suggested, but by no means convincing level.
Could you maybe recap
that? Okay, so the initial WMAP papers, they worked out the correlation function of the temperature function angular scale. And if you plot it, what happens is it becomes very, very flat on large scales. And this is basically related to the fact that quadrupole simply is very low. Though it's slightly different from that. But this flatness, I think, actually depends on how you do it. For example, if you calculate the estimate in a different way, then it becomes less flat. So it's not actually terribly robust, and it's not there at very high significance. The significance is probably something like 90 to 99%, depending on how you calculate it. So it's certainly an interesting hint, maybe, that there is something that we don't know about. But it's not above, way above the 99%. But there are some anomalies on slightly smaller scale people are claiming higher significance. But I'm not quite sure. I think they're probably there as well, because they're more likely to be instrumental artifacts or whatever.
So sorry, that's a stupid question, but that I don't understand. I mean, what does significance mean here? I mean, you say the error bars are so large that they can't make safe conclusion that there are no correlations on scales larger than 60 degrees, or how could that statement be insignificant?
Well, there are different questions that you can ask. I mean, the trouble is we've got the sky. So every question we're asking is a posteriori. So it's a question of how you define the measure over what questions we could have asked a posteriori if we'd had different maps. And then you can think about whether it's a Bayesian analysis or what you're asking about. Frequentist arguments, and they will give slightly different answers to how you ask the question. And indeed, which combination of the data you use and how you do the analysis. So I don't think anyone gets anything very, very significant. Maybe 99.7% of the small scale anomalies. But it's very hard to quantify all the different things you could have looked for if you'd had different maps. Okay, one thing I wanted to do is I wanted to generate a Gaussian matter field, put it out there, and let people analyze it for 3 years. And I'm sure you could find loads and loads of anomalies in it.
So depending on the definition of this measure, how insignificant could that statement be? Is it like of no significance at all? Or?
If you play around simulating maps, I mean, you will find maps that have quadrupoles pretty much the size observed periodically, well, maybe 1 in 10 or 1 in 50 or something. And it could just be a statistical trick.
Mm-hmm. This instrument that you need, how different could they be from
So basically, you just need a whole load of dipole antennas. There are ideas for this moon-based thing. You just basically sprinkle things over the far side of the moon, which are basically rods that expand when you drop them. And you have these dipole antennas, and you send a satellite around the moon collecting the data and transmitting it back to us. So you don't need anything very advanced to detect. From the ground, there are ideas about cylindrical detectors, so chicken wire bases. For most other institutions, I'm a tourist. I don't know much about